Good afternoon, everyone. I want to call the expanded budget committee meeting together. First up is IT, and I see them in their position, followed by probation and community justice after the completion of IT. Welcome, and you're on.
All right, great. So let's get started. Good afternoon, everyone. So Greg's having me do this year, so I'm kind of a newbie to this process, but bear with me.
It's very simple.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Our expenditures, as you can see, there's a change of about $12,000, and that reflects a recommended project assistant for next year, and also has to do with some monies from the public Wi-Fi project. Our revenues dropped slightly, $540, as we're no longer billing some of our departments for NetMotion licenses.
What is NetMotion?
NetMotion is a way we use to connect people in remotely to the network, and we have a different solution now, so it's cheaper. Yep. So our major influences for next year, succession planning with our telecommunication and programming administrator. He's going to retire within the next 2 years, so we're trying to get things in place for that. Capital projects include HR payroll upgrade and potentially moving that to the cloud, and potentially a new time and attendance software. We're also in the need to replace about 8 to 10 of our virtual servers next year. We also have a project with Cortland County, a shared services grant for Teaser that has us putting in some SAN and servers over there. We're also working with public safety and emergency response IT services and potentially doing some restructuring. Probably next year and this year as well, really focusing on security and compliance. As you've all probably heard, a lot going around in that arena with cybersecurity and some of our other counties getting hit pretty hard. Basically, the full-time equivalents, the only change there is an addition of a project assistant at 0.20. Which is right there. OTRs that we're asking for, we took out of our base budget the funding for travel and training. We needed to, we kind of took that out as maintenance of effort for other things that we really needed. Not that we don't need travel and training, but that was one of a piece that we just took out and basically was going to ask for back. The next two line items are one of it being a one-time money for security awareness training to get a program for cybersecurity training up and going. We have a couple of vendors in mind, we'd be doing all sorts of cybersecurity training, including a phishing campaign to kind of train our users on what to look for in phishing emails. The fourth $15,000 annual security audit is to have an external vendor come in and basically kind of look at the big picture when it comes to IT security, everything from our policies to our routers and risk assessments and anything that would have to do as far as the whole picture of security and the way we do business. And that was it.
Questions for IT, Michael, and Anna. Go ahead, Mike Sigler.
I have two questions, actually. That breach that happened over in Schuyler, why there and not here? Like, what do we have in place that they didn't?
Well, they had a user that, and I don't want to necessarily get into specifics. I do know the specifics. I think it could have happened here. It happened to be that they had a user that probably fell for a phishing campaign, clicked on some links, their machine got infected. Once the perpetrator, we'll call him, was able to get inside the machine, inside the network, then it kept trying different usernames and passwords to get a domain admin account. Once it got a domain admin account, then it could just spread wildfire, which is what happened. So that's why we're making a big push on cybersecurity training, because our biggest link or weakness is, you know, our users. They could do something like
that's
that.
Our biggest thing. Yeah. My second question is, I mean, you have a lot of expertise. Do we offer our services to, like, the towns and things like that?
We do a lot with public safety with the towns and villages, and we help them out occasionally with, you know, scoping hardware and, you know, taking trips out to the towns and villages to consult with them. But,
I'm just wondering if we couldn't set something up almost like we do with assessment, and then charge the towns, obviously.
Joe and our department have talked in depth about that.
Census also.
What's that?
My client.
You cooperate with the towns on the census.
Yeah, absolutely. Census is another example of providing support. We also do support in the area of GIS and also in the area of records management, a great deal. So we do a lot of support for the municipalities and the county outside of the traditional role that you might think of for IT. But that is one area that we could talk more about. We already crossed that line with the villages that have police departments in order to support that, but that's about it.
And it just seems like it's getting harder, not easier.
Yes, much more difficult.
A similar question, hearing about Skylar. You know, don't know what happened, but your description of infection, I wonder if it was encryption or something like that that was coming in ransomware. I know a lot of municipalities have been hit with that. Are we more at risk by using more or putting more of our stuff into the cloud systems? Are we so that our backup systems can be infected, or are we protected in some way?
Well, I guess the way I would answer that is that with the situation that happened in Skylar, they had hardly anything in the cloud. They have it all internally. So when they got hit and basically flattened their network, they had very, very minimal. They could have kept operating if there were things in the cloud, because the security for cloud vendors is usually typically separate from what you have on premise. So if somebody gets my username and password, they can run ramp, you know, they can touch whatever I can get a hold of. So a lot of times cloud vendors will actually add a little bit more security to the scenario.
And our backup systems, are they vulnerable or are they protected?
Well, again, I actually went over to Skylar for a day to try to help them out. And the way we do it, and I don't want to necessarily get into specifics.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't want you to.
Yeah. We had two data centers, and the way we do replication and tapes, they happen to I shouldn't necessarily talk specifically about them, but their backups should have saved them.
Okay.
So we do have two data centers in Tompkins County, and there's a complete replication of all the data and the servers, so all the unstructured data that we have on our traditional file servers, the databases that we host in Site and the applications, the servers, as well as the tapes that we do off-site in addition to that. And if we move in the direction I think we're going with the shared services project with Cortland County, that would be a third replication off-site.
But are our two systems totally separated, or are they interconnected in some way?
Interconnected.
So something could find its way?
It's in theory. Yes, it's possible.
Okay. Thank you.
Anna?
Some of my questions were answered, but I had a few additions. You were talking about the training that got pulled out. There were two. I'm going to try to get back to it. The funding for travel and training, obviously, that's staff. Security awareness training, that's across all departments in the county, correct?
Yes.
And that's the one time. Is this a one time that you get every year?
So there's kind of a one-time buy-in to this particular vendor, and then there's just maintenance afterwards.
How often do they do trainings, or is it online and people can do it anytime they want, or are we going to recommend that?
There's both.
Could you speak a little louder?
I'm sorry. They're both. There's phishing campaigns. There's online cybersecurity training. We'd probably give Roger in our office, who is the security and compliance officer, just more tools to be able to go out into the departments and do kind of one-on-one trainings with the departments, mm-hmm. as we find that's sometimes a little bit more valuable.
And how often does he do those?
He does them for the larger departments yearly, and then the smaller departments as he can kind of get in the door.
Mm-hmm. With the phishing campaign, though, we wouldn't be able to target people who really need assistance. Based on the response to that campaign. So if there's a negative response and they fall for something, then we know who to talk to and provide additional training to.
And how often do you find people in our staff falling for clicking on phishing and that we've been able to successfully stop?
And that's what we haven't had a program yet to do.
So this program would allow us to track the diagnostics.
Right. Yep. That's right. So if you have a person that's fallen for the phishing campaign six times after talking to them, you know, all five times before that, then we have, you know, potentially an issue.
So all we know is that we've successfully blocked it, but we don't know if we've blocked anything. There may not have been anything, or there may have been things we just don't know about them because they didn't end up being anything catastrophic.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things that come in phishing campaigns are blocked by our firewalls and our router, mm-hmm. But then there's some that, you know, that potentially could get through.
To answer that question a little bit.
Could you talk a little louder?
Yeah. I'm sorry. We do have a different piece of software that monitors on an active basis what happens on the network. So the encryption that happens traditionally, we would know about it immediately because the other software called Varonis would alert us to the fact that X number of files have been changed in the past, you know, 30 seconds, which is pretty excessive.
Right.
So there's a flag that tells us that. Also, in the case of that, we would know also because the user wouldn't be able to access those files.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And we back up. You're talking about these backups. We back up every day, every night.
And some things every 5-10 minutes.
Okay. Yes. And so the replication that has happened for us in one other scenario for a folder. And so we just deleted everything that was in the folder and replaced it from
back
5 minutes.
And the last question is the annual security audit. Is that something you typically have in the maintenance of operations budget? But this was also pulled out for this year. Is that?
It's a little bit different. In the past, we've done what is known as a risk assessment, and that has been 2 years in a row, but we've included that in some other capital efforts or projects that we've done in conjunction. This is that plus a review of policies, procedures, and any activities that we do for account management internally as well. So it's a little bit more in-depth for security and compliance than just running a traditional risk assessment, which just looks internally at the age and the version of patches that are on our network.
So that's, then this is a new thing that you want to add that will be permanent.
Absolutely. So it's an external perspective of what we do, how we do it, and how to best respond.
Well, given how much cybersecurity issues are becoming the main focus of most governments, not a bad idea.
Martha, go ahead.
Thank you. So the training you're talking about, is that going to be mandatory for everybody at the county? I hope the answer is yes.
Yes.
Sure.
I mean, yes. They're so good. Yeah. No, I'm. It's real. There's. Yeah, you're. Yeah, I know you don't need it. They're so good. I mean, it's like there's it's so easy to be tricked. I mean, they can create the trust company logo. It looks exactly the same, et cetera.
So can the hackers, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that's people need to get the message. There at Association of Counties meeting last week or whenever, we had a presentation by NACO, the National Association, and I handed Joe a folder of stuff where there are a bunch of resources. So I'm sure Joe will share that. Do you have to do any? You mentioned the census. Is there? What's the timing? Are you already doing things getting ready for the census, or will you in 2018, or is that too early to start ramping it up?
In terms of the census project, the first effort is something that is known as LUCA, or Local Update of Census Addresses. And there's been a great deal of coordination, both with Cornell, who's taken the lead from the state. The state has hired Cornell to produce a pilot version of how they might assist local government across New York State. And Tompkins County and two other counties are pilot locations for their efforts at Cornell. In addition, so we've done some coordination with them. We've provided both at the federal and the state level all of our data for the use of the LUCA program. So we've already updated what they had for Tompkins County and relied on more accurate local data to begin the LUCA effort. And in addition, we're coordinating with local government in Tompkins County to offer our assistance in responding to LUCA.
So my question was, I mean, I remember hearing about that a while ago. In terms of money and your staff time, should we be thinking about anything extra for 2018, or you can absorb it and it's not really ramping up until later?
The review of the LUCA can be absorbed into the department as we currently operate within the GIS program and what we do. Once the final census data is published, though, that turns into a different level of work that results in redistricting, which is above and beyond what we have the capability of supporting now.
So that'll be in a few more
years.
That's
2 years after it'll be in 2022.
All right, and one more question. It's really a Joe question. So I see, Joe, that you've said yes to their fourth priority and not to their first, second, or third.
Yeah.
I mean, the project assistant is one time. Okay.
Yes.
Just if you want to tell us about the...
Well, you notice that they're not color-coded. The ones that I didn't fund fall into that category of either being target, which I stayed away from and left to you, or if they're one time, I felt they had policy implications better handled by you than me. But you can see in the way I've color-coded this, I think they're all worthy of support.
Okay.
And if Greg had another couple of minutes, and I don't think he does, what he's proposing to do with the project assistant is really important and might set a precedent, set a precedent for some other departments who want to better diversify their workforce ultimately and kind of groom people for county employment. So maybe after this is all done and you have more time, he'll want to explain that. I think it's a really good initiative.
Thanks very much.
Anyone else? Thank you both. Oh, Julie?
I was looking at your contracts, and you used to make use of Clarity Connect in the computing center, and you don't any longer, and I wondered why.
Computing center, we do. We do a lot of business with the computing center in terms of purchase of equipment off of New York State contracts. The Clarity Connect contract, we used to use Clarity Connect as a redundant internet service provider, but have subsequently switched over to Spectrum because they have the ability to provide direct dark fiber into our secondary data center where Clarity Connect did not.
You said Spectrum.
Yes, that's
okay.
That is Time Warner's.
Yes. Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you both again. Probation, community justice.
Hi, good evening. My name is Pat Buchel. I'm the director of the Department of Probation and Community Justice. And let's proceed. I hope you all like the blue banner that I put in the presentation for you tonight so that it keeps your attention. And I also want to start out by saying that this is the first time in, I believe, 3 years that I've come to you to ask for an OTR. I've been very frugal over the last few years, so the slideshow is a little bit longer this time around. For expenditures and revenues, basically in that third column, you'll see that $12,412 is basically the park grant that we manage for the drug court, so that's revenue coming in. And then in the expenditures, that is revenue, also revenue going out as they spend it over the year. And that figure also includes the $80,000 that was placed in the probation department budget for the reentry coordinator in the contract with CCE, and that money has since been removed from our budget for the planning purposes for 2018. The full-time equivalents remain at 34. However, I am asking for, in the OTR, one FTE position. So if approved, that would actually raise the roster to 35. So what is really influencing my budget and over-target request has to do with the CGR report and the jail population reduction strategies that were listed in that report. And basically, probation's role, what they're recommending is that we increase our impact of our pretrial release program. What they mean is make more release recommendations, obviously. Be more aggressive in those release recommendations. And one of the things that they are recommending is that we, for those high-risk people who score very high on the failure to appear scale in the pretrial evaluation and assessment, that we really strongly consider utilizing electronic monitoring as a release recommendation of the release under supervision. The second major jail reduction strategy that they are encouraging is to increase the capacity of the misdemeanor drug court or the Ithaca Community Treatment Court. So in that vein, I am requesting an OTR of a senior probation officer position that would give us the appropriate staffing level in the misdemeanor drug court program and also would facilitate the electronic monitoring pretrial release workload. So this is what I envision with this one FTE senior probation officer. There would be a dual assignment and focus for the staff person. They would be focusing on the pretrial release with electronic monitoring population and also be supervising individuals in the Ithaca Community Treatment Court. So with pretrial release and EM, the role of the senior PO would be to install the EM equipment on individuals who are released by the courts pretrially and monitor adherence to the rules, review reports, address any violations, communicate with the order in court as necessary, and then obviously maintaining the face-to-face contact with the pretrial release participant as ordered by the court. So that could be as little as once a week or could be as much as five times a week. It depends on what the judge orders. In Ithaca Community Treatment Court, their role would be to assume 10 to 15 of the current participants that are currently involved in that program. The SPO who is currently assigned to that program really is overburdened. He has too many cases, I feel, to deal effectively and efficiently with this population. So not only assuming 10 to 15 current, but the new senior PO would also absorb any new clients coming into the program as a result of our ability to expand. Right now, we're kind of limited in expanding because it's too much for the senior probation officer assigned to that program. So what would the effect on the jail population be if you were to grant this over-target request? Well, CGR believes that in pretrial RUS with EM that we could successfully reduce the jail population by 10 inmates a day. I think that's a little ambitious. I suggest that 5 inmates a day could be a more realistic expectation, and then we could possibly grow that number as we see how things go. Remember, this is we're going to be being more aggressive with our release recommendations, and so we have to see how this goes. We have to see how comfortable this is going to be. We're going to have to see if this is a successful match. And with the Ithaca Community Treatment Court expansion, CGR believes, and this is kind of a big math here, that by expanding the current census by 10 participants per year, that would save an average of jail time of 5 months per person, plus offset by any jail sanctions imposed by the program, but they believe 5 months overall. And that would equate to about 1,550 days saved per year, or 4.2 beds per day. I believe expanding the Ithaca Community Treatment Program by 10 or more participants is realistic and doable. So I'm calling this slide the break-even. So this is the math of how many inmates per day we would need to reduce the jail population by to break even with the cost of this OTR, the cost of this FTE, senior probation officer. So we did the math. CGR believes, according to their calculations, we could reduce the population by 14.2 inmates a day by taking on this dual focus. We think 9.2 is more realistic, but the break even cost is 3.5 inmates per day. Okay, and I would be remiss if I weren't here to just chat a little bit about a future unknown that could affect next year's budget presentation, and that's the financial impact of Raise the Age legislation. So effective October 1st of 2018, 16-year-olds will no longer be considered adults in the criminal courts. They will move to the family court arena. And 17-year-olds move a year later, October 1st, 2019. So there are financial implications for other departments as well, but I'm focusing mostly on probation and what our role is in providing the steps to make sure we implement Raise the Age within the department. So one of the first things that the legislation talks about is the mandate to provide what's called voluntary services. I put that in quotes because we don't know what that means at this point. But we are required to provide those kinds of services to all 16 and 17-year-old adolescent offenders, which is a new title applied to 16 and 17-year-olds charged with felonies. And these cases will be going to the county court, and they will be seen in a special part of county court called Youth Part. So we're not sure at this point what this means for probation. We don't know if it means we have to have a staff person assigned to that court when the youth appears to do reach out to the family and the youth to talk about voluntary services. We don't know if it means we have to start seeing the youth and the family if they agree to voluntary services. We don't know we have to put them through the risk assessment and start doing case planning with them. So this is all a huge unknown. All 16 and 17-year-olds charged with a misdemeanor will be diverted to probation via an appearance ticket for JD intake services. So currently, 16 and 17-year-olds who are charged with a crime go to criminal court. We don't see them. The criminal courts are dealing with them in the courtroom. I mean, sometimes we are asked to do a pre-sentence investigation on that population, but many times they are imposing sentences without probation getting involved. Well, that all changes with this legislation. Every single 16 and 17-year-old charged with a misdemeanor will be walking through our door. And we will be obligated to provide 2 to 4 months of intake services to that youth. And then finally, there is a mandate to provide evidence-based services to all 16 and 17-year-olds. That's very ill-defined. We don't know if the state is going to be indicating which services are evidence-based, if they're going to be dictating which services to provide, or if we're going to be allowed a little leeway in deciding promising programs or other activities and things we can be doing with youth that are currently available. So to recap, basically unknowns are the staffing levels to meet the influx of the intake cases that will be walking through our door, the increased workload due to providing voluntary services to these adolescent offenders in the youth part, and then finding and paying for those evidence-based practices and meeting the funding requirements by the state for reimbursement, which presently is tied to counties meeting their tax cap. And if they can't meet the tax cap, being able to prove financial burden or financial hardship to the state budget office. So that is my presentation.
I welcome questions. Mike, go ahead.
A couple things, Pat. A general thing, and you're asking for another probation officer because you're adding more work. But how are we doing with the caseload for your others? Are they handling it all right? Are they overworked? Are they underworked? Where are we?
I would say the senior probation officer positions are a little high at this point in time, and the probation officers are probably right about where they need to be.
Are we equivalent to other counties in the region or other areas?
You know, that's a good question because every county is so different, and we did a work caseload study report years ago, and it's kind of all over the map in terms of caseload numbers. Yeah, so I can't really give you a definitive about that.
Yeah. The other thing I wondered about, wanted to talk about the electronic monitoring.
Yes.
I read that in the CGR report and kind of opened my eyes a little bit, wondering whether this is a good thing for us. I remember when electronic monitoring started here and our concerns about the careful selecting of those individuals that might be candidates for that. Now I hear CGR saying, well, we're not being aggressive enough, and we can actually take some people out, which could of jail if we just were more aggressive. But to me, that's an increase in risk. And I wondered if you might talk about that and, you know, what are the kinds of risks that we have to be worried about when you're evaluating candidates for this?
So the you heard me talk about the risk of failure to appear, and that really is the thing you're supposed to be looking at. It's really not the nature of the crime, except for in cases of domestic violence where the court has to take into other considerations whether they violated previous orders of protection, whether they have access to weapons. So those are other things they can take into consideration when deciding release for someone from jail. But really, truly, we're supposed to be looking at their failure to appear, and we have this validated assessment tool that we use on every individual that we interview, and it gives us a risk score, low, medium, or high, for failure to appear. So we've been a little nervous about recommending release for those high failure to appears, because if they don't show up to probation or they don't show up for the court appearance, then there's some concern. I mean, we want to be able to keep track of them and make sure they're showing up for their appearances and at various appointments. So yes, that is the reason why we're a little bit nervous about and being more aggressive in those medium to high, or those high to high risk people that we want to start taking a look at. And starting out with a more conservative number, they think 10, we think 5 is the more conservative, until we feel comfortable that, you know what, this is a good tool to use for these high risk. I guess I'd like it to be proven that it's going to be a good resource for us.
I have some real questions about what you're going to find.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to talk with you more
Thank
about
you.
That
I'm
as
not
well.
Criticizing you. I wonder if the report is being too optimistic.
Well, one thing I can tell you with the senior probation position is that their obligation is to come in every morning and look at the reports. If there's a rules violation, we're immediately notifying the sentencing court. So it doesn't linger. It goes immediately back to the court. And if the person is not appearing to their appointments, then usually the judge will get them back before them, either on a warrant or... So it's quick. It's a quick response. Things don't linger.
Thank you.
Martha.
Thanks, Pat. I'm really supportive of this new position. I wanted to know about perform outreach to the justice courts. You had said in the description. What would that look like? What would this person be doing?
Yeah, one of the things I've questioned is that, as you know, the local justice courts can transfer cases to Ithaca Community Treatment Court, and that number has been low. So my vision for this new position, along with the existing PO, is to do some outreach to the justice courts. I think it's part of our judicial training as well that I was talking about at public safety, to talk about how do you do that, what cases are appropriate, and for them to have that face-to-face with the PO so that they know they can call the PO and talk it out, or talk with the ADA. But, yeah, I think just reaching out to the courts and letting them know, reminding them that this is an option, in that face-to-face venue would be helpful. And that will expand the program if it's successful, mm-hmm. as well.
So in a sense, it might not be any shift in... It might end up having more clients pre-release. Now, actually, if somebody's arraigned in this and they're not sent to jail awaiting trial, you don't always get engaged with them, right? Only if you're saying electronic monitoring could be used that way, but you don't.
We only get engaged with them if the court orders them to be released under our supervision.
Okay.
So there's three ways that can happen. They can be released under the supervision to my probation assistant, Bernadette Stranger. And they can come in up to 1 to 5 times a week. They can be released to the supervision of the day reporting program, which you know, and now this way with electronic monitoring. But the probation assistant, because of the level of and complexity of the electronic monitoring, the hookup, the installation, the rules, the monitoring of the reports, that's not a function she can handle. So that's why we need the senior. And it's always been a senior probation officer function, electronic monitoring, within the department.
Okay. And I see, Joe, that you've got it down here for that you didn't include it in the budget, but you are suggesting that this position be included.
Yes.
Okay. Will.
Thanks, Jim.
Hi,
Pat.
Hi.
You skated over, or you mentioned the reentry contract with extension. Was that the reentry coordination, or and you have $75,000 in, but it's not defined who that would be with.
So we had we managed the contract with Cooperative Extension for the reentry coordinator position.
Okay.
And that money was deposited into the probation budget last year, and we've been paying those quarterly invoices. So with the advent of some changeover, Cooperative Extension ends in end of the year. That money was removed from our budget, and this was in agreement with county administration to do that at this time, just so not to confuse things, I guess. Right.
And there's still some money that stays with probation. So there were some things, was a day reporting, where some money went over to probation to
yes.
support that. Out of the 100 that you allocated, that stays. It's the remaining 80 that will find its way. If you decide to fund the mental health initiative, that's where that money will end up, is with mental health.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
Pat, what happens if a 17-year-old kills someone?
So they would go to youth part. This is after they move into...
Right.
They would go to the youth part in county court, and all of the...
and it's charged with...
All of the sentencing options that are currently used in criminal court would be used in the youth part.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Martha.
Pat, I just remember, wasn't there in the reentry $100,000 we put into target, wasn't there piece of it that was supposed to be grant writing?
Is that 10,000 was for the grant writing piece. Yeah.
So did that happen at all?
No.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, thanks.
The money wasn't spent either.
No, it was not spent.
Any other questions for Pat? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
DSS, and I noticed they're all here. Come on up.
So hello, I am Kit Kephart. I'm the acting commissioner at the Department of Social Services. And I've worked at DSS for a long time and had some involvement in budget planning, but most of that's been kind of around the program end of things and how that affects budget. So most recently I've had a bit of a crash course, so bear with me as I kind of jump into this piece of the process. And with me tonight are Tom Herden, our Director of Administrative Services, and Dina Bodner, our program planner. So getting started on slide one, in the 2018 budget, we're asking for about $45 million, which is $956,000 less than our 2017 budget of $46 million. This represents a decrease of 2% budget, which I'll talk in our budget, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a moment. And as you can see, our projected revenues are about $500,000 less for 2018. Our net local is also about 2% changed, having been lowered about $417,000. The key reason behind the 2% decreases in both expenses and revenue are really declining caseloads in two of our mandate programs. We're seeing a decrease in both family assistance, which are a temporary assistance program, as well as our child care programs. Whereas our previous slide shows our department's budget for the entire department, this slide really shows those same figures by budgeting unit. And we'll talk a bit more in a minute about what those units are comprised of. So our next slide is showing our expenditures graphically. I see the gray looks white when we're looking at it on the large slide. So to look at the budget for the Department of Social Services a little bit differently, 16% of the budget is covering programs for children and families. Economic assistance makes up about 20%. Our medical assistance or Medicaid programs are at about 26% of the budget. And finally, planning and coordination, which is our administrative costs, including staffing, make up about 39%. So let's look at what those programs actually are. As we look at programs by budgeting unit, they really break out into our services to children and families, which is foster care and adoption, our JD and PINS, state training schools. We look at economic assistance, which is our family assistance and safety net, daycare and HEAP, which is the home energy program, and our one-time emergency assistance program. Our medical assistance, which is our Medicaid programs, and then our planning and coordination, which is all of our administrative costs, including our staff, and other supplies, as well as our program contracts and our purchase of service for clients. So now that we've reviewed how the programs are organized into the budgeting units, our next slide really shows us how our expenditures are broken out by programs. So if you look at our administrative costs, those might seem high, but I want to take a minute to actually consider some of the off-budget program benefits. So residents of Tompkins County benefit from about $113 million in Medicaid funding that are distributed in provider payments directly from state and federal programs. And the same with the $11 million for SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, what we know as food stamps, and our $2 million in HEAP, which is our Home Energy Assistance Program. If these benefits were to show in our budget, our overall budget would be about $171 million, four times larger than it actually is, and our administrative budget would actually make up only 9% instead of the 36% that we currently see. So up to this point, we've focused on expenditures. The chart on the next slide shows us the distribution of our net local cost. This slide shows us a breakdown of our net local cost by budgetary unit as well as program. The first two radial diagrams were showing expenditures, but the largest local contribution goes to the medical assistance category, which is our Medicaid contribution. Because of variations in our reimbursement rates of different programs, the distribution of our net local costs looks different from our distribution of expenditures. For example, medical assistance is 25% of our overall budget, while here you can see that it's 59% of our net local cost. When we look at family assistance, that makes up 87% of all of our expenditures, but again, when we look here, it actually makes up only a tenth of a percent of our net local costs, so it really depends on how we're looking at that. Up to this point, we've been looking at the department's budget as a whole. Now we can look at some particular aspects like staffing. Full-time equivalents refer to our number of staff that we're paying for in our budget, and this year we're seeing a reduction by one, and this is really reflecting a net change of many changes over this year and next year. We've added and subtracted positions over time in a variety of different program areas and divisions that result in one fewer FTE overall. It's not just one specific position. And then among the changes in numbers of positions that change between this year and next year, I want to talk a little bit about a couple of changes that we've seen. Our case supervisor A in our child welfare division, we were actually able to reclassify a case supervisor to a case supervisor A. The child welfare division at DSS is really experiencing great changes as a result of regulatory revisions, where those are all imposed by OCFS, the governing body of child welfare, which is the Office of Children and Family Services. In the past few years, we've seen a significant uptake in the numbers of new regulations, new initiatives, audits, training requirements that really impact us at the local level. Our director of services has had difficulty balancing his job time between handling the many state requirements and the very important job of giving direction to the eight supervisors in that division. And so this case supervisor A really fills the gap. This position really provides direct supervision and ongoing guidance to the supervisor, while the director of services can really focus on the managing upcoming initiatives and audits and directives. The senior social welfare examiner position, we're really looking forward to this position as a new resource to help address mostly housing concerns in our community. This position will work with the reentry population, the population that's coming out of jail. They'll really provide linkages to many, many benefits and services, including housing, that this group needs. And will provide inspections and reviews of rental properties as people are looking for housing. And this position will also provide support and education to empower clients to research and find housing independently. We're really hoping to add that education component as opposed to really having very limited options for people. The transition workforce specialist, casework assistant, this is a position in our adult protective services unit and will work with the adult protective population. This position is really there to try to take pressure off of caseworkers who are finding more and more that they're really having to provide much more intensive supports to individual clients. Some of this we're seeing as a result of the opioid epidemic, that people are coming to us with greater need, sometimes with real substance issues or mental health problems. We also rely on this position to provide education and supports to representative payee clients, which have increased almost to 30% in the last 2 years. So we have a greater population of folks there. And this will also contribute to supporting clients in maintaining housing or finding new The transition workforce specialist is a position that will support our employment division. Our department has been working with Workforce New York and many other partners to address the new WIOA legislation, which is the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act that has come about. This is really, as far as DSS sees that legislation, it will really support people with barriers to seeking employment, looking to really support people in greater ways. It's a position that will assist us as people are searching for jobs. It will help make more of a link to some of the contract supports that we provide for searching for jobs. We have a contract with Challenge Workforce Solutions and TC3. Both provide job readiness and job support services. And it's a position that will also assist in helping assess which people may not be appropriate for job readiness, maybe due to addiction or mental health challenges.
Can you name the act again?
Workforce Opportunity and Investment Act. It's WIOA, W-I-O-A, W-I-O-A, yeah. So let's move on to over-target requests that are in our recommended budget. We have a fatherhood initiative. This is a case management program run by Catholic Charities. It provides individual and group supports to fathers, mostly fathers, who are trying to re-engage with the parenting process. And it's a program that will really support our child welfare work and specifically will help engage fathers and sometimes mothers who are going through the Family Treatment Court program. That's a huge piece of keeping families engaged and keeping people engaged in that parenting process. Our health and safety grants for prospective registered daycare providers. This over-target request will support the renewal of a contract with the Child Development Council that allows the council to provide grants to daycare providers to address issues in their home, either to maintain their status as registered providers or to become registered providers. It's really important to keep the quality of daycare in our community there, and also important to keep our daycare options diversified and really allowing people multiple options. The hybrid fleet vehicle plug-ins recommended or over-target request, in keeping with the county going green, this next over-target request represents the additional cost of making 5 replacement hybrid vehicles plug-ins so that the cars can be plugged in overnight to charge their batteries. There's always more electricity than gasoline. So we have an additional over-target request for legislative consideration, which we're excited about. The STEP expansion, which will help us continue to address homelessness and housing concerns within the county. This is a grant that combines federal HUD monies with New York State funds. We've been administering this grant for about 7 years. This is a grant that Dina's worked hard on. And we contract with TC Action to run 2 program components of rapid rehousing and then homelessness prevention. It's such an important program to serve the homeless population by supporting them with funds to go into housing that they otherwise would not be able to afford. And then to pay, the way it works is we pay a declining share of the rent over the next year to work with folks. And then we're also working with folks that are facing eviction and thereby preventing homelessness. So it's really a 2-part program. It's been a really successful program providing permanent housing in the rapid rehousing part of the program to 15 of 21 households, and then preventing eviction in 70 to 88, 70 of 88 households in our community. In the case of rapid rehousing, most of the time people stayed in their housing successfully. When they didn't, they were actually able to move to another stable home. So what we saw was that stability was maintained even if they didn't stay in the initial apartment that they were in, that they went into initially. We're placing this important program in our budget as an over-target request because the grant funds only covered about 70 to 75% of the need, and we really need an additional $42,000 to fill that gap and continue the program. So up to this point, we've been talking about our budget, but now we're going to review things that have changed since our submission and may impact our budget next year. Things change rather unpredictably when we're talking about state and federal funding, and some examples of some things that have changed are the New York State Child Care Block Grant. Our most recent allocation was $200,000 less than anticipated, which should be okay for the current year, but going forward, we expect that next year's allocation may be lower still, and we may need to request additional local funding or make eligibility requirements different. Or institute a wait list, which is not something we look to do if we can avoid it. Another unanticipated change was our foster care and adoption subsidy rates. New York State raised them by 3.25%. We anticipated only a 2% raise. So we have to wait to see in 2018 what the net local impact is going to be and how much the foster care block grant has increased in next year's state budget. And here we see the impact of the state training schools rate. This budget figure represents youths that are placed in OCFS, Office of Children and Family Services, custody. We have budgeted for one youth for a whole year, but any placement that occurs lasts for 6 months as a minimum. And once the child is in a state custody, and care is provided at various levels. So a medium placement is about $60,000. All of this makes the cost very unpredictable and very expensive when placements take place. Each year we're billed by the state for 2 years prior, and presently we expect a 2018 bill about half of the amount in our budget request. But that is kind of an unknown at this point. So some good news. We're pleased that the family treatment court locally was awarded the federal SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration grant that will begin this fall. This is a grant that will provide increased psychosocial evaluations for parents of our family treatment court participants. This will really allow us to work with families a bit more holistically, really see the full picture of what's happening with them and their children. And we'll also be able to support the work of our family treatment court team in addressing concerns and issues that they struggle with. And our last couple of slides have shown things that have changed and the next few slides show factors that have the potential to impact our 2018 budget. One of those is Medicaid, which is in kind of an unpredictable state. We continue to wait to see what happens with the Affordable Care Act and the repeal or replacement of Obamacare to see how this is going to be impacted. It has the potential to impact eligibility for our clients and the funding structure as it currently exists. New York State has also been talking for several years now about a state takeover of the service provision of Medicaid. And while that hasn't really happened in full, we continue to try to plan and manage for that potential because we just don't know what's coming with that. New York, as Pat Buchel indicated, has also passed a piece of legislation called Raise the Age. This will begin with 16-year-olds in October of 2018. There's not a lot of information. Pat shared some with you. There's not a lot of information available yet, but DSS is working with a countywide team to try to address planning for this in ways that we can. And some other factors that have the potential to impact our 2018 budget, we continue to see our Child Protective Services needs increase to compound the challenge, cases are becoming more difficult. Much of this is attributable to social challenges like the opioid epidemic that we're seeing. And lastly, we're expecting some New York State-driven IT changes in 2018. There's a statewide initiative to replace WMS, which is the Welfare Management System. That's a database that's been in place since the 1970s, believe it or not, with a new statewide system called the IES, which is the Integrated Eligibility System. WMS is the database for all eligibility-related client data that the Department of Social Services uses to process cases. We and most of the other DSSs across the state met last year with a state IES team to really talk about how we use WMS and what's the extensive information that we would need to get rolled into the IES program and how they develop that system. We're hopeful that this new system will replace the WMS system. It is really ailing at this point. At the same time, it's been implemented in one other state, and it's been a bumpy transition. As you can imagine, with a system that's been in place since 1970, it's difficult to come in and know everything that system's doing right now and make a full transition quickly. So they're trying, but we anticipate that could end up impacting us in ways that we don't anticipate right now. So thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you. Questions for Kit and company. Anna, Martha.
So I have a ton of questions. I'll probably end up just calling a new meeting with you so I can understand everything in greater detail. But just a few overarching ones. You gave a list of positions that you are excited about that are being added, I think, unless I understood it wrong, on page 5, positions change. It sounded like all of these were being added, or the first one, is the case supervisor a higher level, a lower level? How does that...
It is a higher level. That position supervises all of the other case supervisors. So it is a higher level, but we did yes, there is a higher expenditure there, but we did reclassify one of those positions into that position.
Okay.
So it's not a full new position.
And so the three others are new, but the total change in FTEs is one less. What was lost or removed or?
So it's kind of hard to say. That's so what happens at DSS is over time we are constantly making adjustments. Programs kind of change, and we're constantly looking at how we are making slight adjustments or slight changes over the course of a long period of time.
Depending on needs shifting.
Yeah, so it's not like we took one position and said we don't need that anymore. It's really the culmination of as programs change or as positions get adjusted, it's kind of a net result.
So these are new positions. Are there employees that are currently on the roles that will be moved into these positions, or their current positions are being reclassified, or you're hiring new people and we're losing some people? Can you describe that personnel?
So it's kind of different for each one. The case supervisor A is a position that we bumped up, and so we filled that with somebody who was currently at the department. The senior social welfare examiner, the casework assistant, and the transition workforce specialist, those are all new for 2018, so we don't obviously have those filled. So it may be possible that we fill those. Typically what we may end up doing is promoting from within and then potentially filling at a lower level with somebody from a list.
Okay.
So it's kind of hard to know exactly right now how that'll happen. But.
And the last question you mentioned, I mean, I know that there's in this department more than many, a lot of unknowns that we're dealing with. And I guess this is a question for Joe and both of you together, especially with respect to Medicaid. You mentioned preparing. I think I heard you say that word, and I'm wondering how we are
are we setting any money aside in contingency? In what way, maybe non-monetarily, are we preparing for potential changes and monetarily?
I can speak to that programmatic.
I'll speak to the programmatic, and I'll speak to the money side of it.
Thank you. Okay. So we have been working for a couple of years now programmatically to really streamline things, to really make sure that we are doing everything that we can to maximize every position that's working in Medicaid so that if the state suddenly came in and did take over or went through some sweeping changes, we would not be in a position where we had any more people than we had to working in that program. And that because the majority of the people that work in Medicaid are all social welfare examiners, as well as the people that work in SNAP and temporary assistance are also in that job title, it really means that we're program planning not just for Medicaid, but really through all of our eligibility programs.
So there's cross-training, you mean, going on?
Cross-training, trying to look at wherever we can, trying to really trim and make things as streamlined as we can so that things are working as efficiently as they can without adding any additional supports in that program.
And before I jump to you, I did have one other question, which is how the moving from the 16 going into youth and the 17 going into youth for, the presentation that we got from Pat Uschel, how that's affecting DSS. That was another question I had, but, yeah.
I'll let Kit answer the programmatic question. On the money side on Medicaid, I mean, the one reason that we want to keep our reserves relatively high is to brace for things like change that can happen in the Medicaid program. And, we've used words like nimble and resilience and things like that. That's what we're talking about. So we could experience some abrupt change, and I agree with Kit. We've done a lot programmatically to try to make sure that we can navigate through, and we've tightened our belt as much as we can. But sometimes these things happen. I'm frankly most concerned about Medicaid, and if money is taken away from the state's been very generous about sharing the windfall they got through ACA. And I think that probably lays ground for them to say, when it's gone, now we need to take it back. And I worry about that money impact. So, again, our reserves right now are in pretty good shape. And that's why we have been pretty strong in saying that we ought to keep those reserves at current levels to be able to adopt to that kind of change.
What about 20%?
We're at about 20%, yeah.
So the other was the 16-17 programmatic.
So, unfortunately, I don't have a lot of information to share there. We are, like I said, we are really working with a countywide team to start to look at that. A group of us from the county went to, we've gone to a couple of different Raise the Age kind of information sessions. And I think slowly the state is beginning to give us a bit more information, but there really isn't a lot yet, and so we're waiting for that program information to kind of roll out. I think probably the probation side of things has a little bit more information because they are a bit more connected to the court process and how that's going to affect them. But honestly, as we get more information, I can share it, but we don't have a lot about how Raise the Age is going to...
So last time we heard, they weren't going to add any funding associated with it, and that's still where it's at.
Right now, Tom, I think that they're...
What the state is saying is kind of talking out of both sides of their mouth. They're saying that the state will cover 100% of the costs, except if a county is not in compliance with the tax cap or is not in some financial dire straits that it's not of its own making. So
we have to be destitute and not go over our cap.
One or the other, I think.
Great. Lovely.
Yeah.
I have Martha Robertson.
Really good job, Kit, for not... You say you're not the budget person, but a lot of information really well explained. I'm glad to see the additional the senior examiner for housing and all of these three areas look really important. On child care, you've got that grant. Let me see. I'm looking at our page 6. It's your 11th slide. $10,000 one-time for health and safety grants for daycare providers. Didn't we do that last year and parked it in DSS so that the Child Development Council could use it for facility improvements for people's houses if they need, because there were new requirements. So is that what this is?
Yes. Yep, same thing, yes.
So is this a new 10, a new 10,000?
It is.
Yeah.
So Child Development Council did use that. That money was went to good use.
Yes, I think that they're using it. They're using it just as we are projecting for next year. That they're really trying to provide that as grants to people to either keep their certification or develop certification. Yep.
And you say we have enough child care money for the subsidy for we don't have a waiting list for child development child care subsidies. Is that right?
No, and we haven't for a long time, so we're hoping not to go in that direction. The way that our child care subsidy works is they give us money, and then if that money is not all spent, then they lower that. And so we've been seeing declining numbers. We're looking at how we can address that, and we're really, frankly, trying to figure out exactly why that's happening. Because that is a program that we are really working to try and make active. So that's one of the challenges to that money is that we're trying to kind of balance out where we've been and then what the need is, and try to, if we end up needing more money, trying to get back to where we'll have money to serve people.
So do you have ideas for recruitment, for really advertising that the subsidies are available, making sure people know about it?
Yeah, we did. This summer, our daycare staff worked with a team that really worked on. So some of this money is, it's all daycare money. Some of this is what you think of as traditional daycare, and then some of that money really goes into our summer camp program, which is a form of daycare. We don't think of it that way, but that's a huge support to families. So our daycare staff really worked this summer with a group of people, community folks, to really look at how do we get the word out about that program, how do we really support people in accessing that, and I think we're going to be doing some similar programming, brainstorming, and community work around daycare as well, the traditional daycare.
Yeah, I mean, I'd really, we do hear that the subsidies aren't, that people don't really know that it's available or what the requirements are. So anything we can do to streamline that, make it easier to apply, that sort of thing would certainly be good. All right, thanks very much.
Sure.
Thank you.
Rich.
Thanks. I had a couple questions. One is on slide 16, you talk about the foster care and adoption rate or subsidy rates. Is this good news or bad news? Who pays and who gets paid?
Do you want to speak to that, Tom?
So an increase in rates is good for the families that provide foster care or who have adopted children who have special needs, and so they qualify for a subsidized adoption. Financially, whether it's good or neutral for the county, for the department and the county, will depend on. So this year the state raised those rates, those mandatory rates. They did not this year raise the foster care block grant that determines how much state reimbursement comes to local districts for those payments. We won't know until after the state budget passes next year and each district gets its allocation of next year's foster care block grant, whether or not will more or less be held harmless, or whether this will increase our local costs.
Okay, thank you. My other question is on the STEP program, and it looks like you've been doing this for 7 years. I'm curious, why is this one-time money? It seems like it's systemic at this point.
I think we're asking at this point for one time. There's a number of housing programs in the community that are getting additional funds in the next year, so I think we're just asking for one time so we see where things fall out this next year. TC Action's got some grant money in a housing program. Catholic Charities will be doing some work with families, and so if all those things come into play and kind of catch some of these folks, then we won't need it longer term. If we still have a strong need, we might be back.
Thank you.
I have a question, and then Mike. I listened fairly closely, and I guess my question is simply, are you feeling okay about the budget being adequate for 2018?
Yeah, I think it is adequate for 2018. I think we've got some strong things in place to address a number of concerns. One of those, as you'll see, there's a central theme through almost everything, which is housing. And I think that we're putting some pieces in place that will really help with that. We've got some new initiatives. I think the unknowns make us all nervous, but I'm not sure that there's a way to plan more directly for those until we know more. So,
I mean, it's my sense that the DSS has been in the unknown business for many years.
Yes, it is central to our business, unfortunately. Yeah. Yes.
It's part of your DNA. thank you for that. Mike Sigler.
My question's kind of quick, I guess. So you're not using all the grant money when it comes to child care, right? That's what we were talking about earlier. That money's not really all getting used. I'm wondering, is it a problem with subsidies?
Oh, I see what you're saying, yes.
The subsidy part. Is it a problem with the subsidies, or is it a problem that we just don't have enough providers? And if it's the provider end of things, is $10,000 going to be enough? Like, this prospective registered daycare providers. I mean, I see a lot of that now. And, yeah, people don't really know what they're doing. And I'm just wondering, is $10,000, is that going to be enough? Or is it even a provider issue, or is it a subsidy? I don't know.
So the money that is... the money that is going, that's in the over target, that's going to the daycare council is that $10,000 is really separate from our daycare subsidy. I think we have talked a lot with the daycare council, and I think that $10,000 is adequate for what they need. Most of what they're doing is kind of covering things that providers need, grants that providers need to make those modifications to their home or to do whatever they need to get their certification or maintain it. And that's a relatively small need. It's kind of filling a gap. With the daycare subsidy, that's a greater challenge, and I think we are, well, maybe I am, really in the process at this point of trying to figure out what is happening with that program. Sometimes it can be really difficult to know exactly why those numbers have dropped, and we are working within DSS, but also with the Daycare Council, the Child Development Council, to really work with them to try to look at a number of different factors that might be influencing why that's dropped. I think we've got some exploration to do around that to try to figure out what's happening.
Has the gap just become too great? Like the subsidy versus the cost is so far. I mean, that probably used to be a gap like this, and now it's a gap like this. People just kind of give up.
Yeah, I don't think that it's so much that gap. Do you want to speak to that, Tom? Do you have
the state reviews and revises the subsidy levels every 2 years? I don't remember if it's this fall or next fall. I believe it's next fall that will be the next new set of rates. So the good news is that they update those fairly frequently, at least compared to other state rates. The bad news is that the methodology is somewhat suspect. They send to daycare providers, they send them a very complicated data request. They get a fairly small response, and then they aggregate 8 or 10 counties together into a single group, and from that, they promulgate the rates, and then those rates that they promulgate, if I'm not mistaken, I think they have to be 80% of the average rate for that conglomeration of counties. I've never understood why they think that 80% of what is being charged on average to private people will be enough to provide for reasonable quality daycare, but that's the way that the Office of Children and Family Services has done it historically.
There's a number of other challenges that I think we have to really evaluate. The state has really changed the way that providers request funding and the way that providers, the requirements for providers to become certified, and it's really changing a lot of, so some of it is training requirements, some of it is that they've really gone from a system where people went into the Child Development Council and filled out paper forms and worked with staff directly to really doing most of it now online and having to do a lot of things by computer. I think there's a lot of factors there that we're trying to figure out what is affecting it. It's a population of people that may not always have access to technology, and sometimes technology can be a real barrier for people. So there's a lot of pieces that I think we have to look at, but we've started that process, and we're really trying to investigate what's happening both on the provider side and getting subsidy benefits to clients as well. So,
and a last question. We're falling behind here.
Just a quick question. I'd heard that we're actually 700 to 800, that there are 700 to 800 children in Tompkins County that are lacking daycare right now. Isn't that true? That's the estimate that I heard from Child Development.
I haven't heard that, but that could be true. I'm not sure. That's something I'll ask about.
Yeah, it's just disturbing to hear that fewer, given the lack of beds or lack of space that we actually have. So I'd.
There are definitely increases, like I said, to providers wanting to be providers and staying providers. I'll ask about that. I'll try to find out more information.
Dooley, go ahead.
Thank you. I believe there are DSS attorneys, but when I was looking at your list of full-time equivalents, I don't see that as a line. Where are they listed?
It's under social services attorney.
It's under S.
Thank you.
We're done here? I'm sorry. Any other questions? Thank you, Kit and team. Sheriff's Office, followed by the Sheriff's Office Jail. And we'll end up with emergency response. We could do all three at the same time.
That'd be nice.
We're not going to play music, so.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll try to be a little quicker and get back on track on your schedule if we can. All right. You can see the figures that we have here. And on the next slide, I will explain where the variables are and why. Some of our major influences that have taken place is, first of all, a decrease in paper services. I guess sometimes we can perceive from that that maybe the economy is turning around and is really actually doing good for our people, and we're not having to garnish wages and things like that. So that's how we perceive that. Doesn't mean that our work in the civil department has decreased in other areas, and one big increases is right there, the pistol permits. They have really gone right out of sight. We're very busy with those, and that is a huge increase in that civil office. So, with road patrol staff absences, we've unfortunately had people off on extended leaves for various reasons, some being health reasons, some disciplinary. So that has been a very big burden on the road patrol. Overtime is there. We try to manage it to the best of our abilities. some of the activities that take place in this county that were not reimbursed by other agencies such as grassroots and things, and we wish we were, have taken some of our overtime to the level that it's gone. And we have worked on trying to convince people to help us out with that, but hasn't been too fruitful at this point in time. Decrease in revenue from the airport, and that's due to our negotiating a new contract with the Road Patrol and getting part-timers. We are using part-time deputies over in the airport as much as possible, and we're still working, obviously, at getting a contingent of part-timers. Also, use of these part-timers, we see hopefully down the road that it'll be very beneficial without having to increase full-timers. We can free them up. You'll see the numbers here. You can see in 2017, it looks like we have a half a person working for us, and that was because we had to get somebody to take care of our body cams. And now you see in 2018, it looks like we're adding one and a half more with 46. And again, that's to do with the part-time people that we're putting out there.
There were no OTRs that were supported. Some of them were asked for, but we were able to work them into the base budget without having to ask for over-target requests. You'll see the list of over-target requests for the road and civil in front of you. These requests were put in, I believe, in July of this year, and subsequent to that, in working with county administration and with county personnel, we are now in a position to be able to pull our priority one, which is obviously the largest one there. We do, without getting into a whole lot of personnel type stuff, we were able to replace an absence, a sorely needed absence, in our civil office. As a matter of fact, the gentleman will be starting next Monday. We even with that, with the addition of that person, we are still not at the level that we were in 2009 when cuts occurred. The workload really hasn't gone down. We pull this much to the chagrin of the folks that work in the civil office. But I guess I'll get into kind of a broader discussion about personnel once we get through this list. Priority number two is something that you've seen before. It has to do with the county's contribution really to the city for ERT. We call this ERT now. It's actually a combination of the SINT team and the SWAT team, but it's all part of an emergency response. Years ago, I know Joe and I met with officials from the city about this very topic, and there is a very valid point to be made for this money. We agreed then that we should be able to work out a way to pay that, and we feel as though that figure should be put into target, and we will pay for our members on the SWAT team. The county will, out of that. The sheriff told you about part-time deputies. This is something that was negotiated in the last collective bargaining agreement. realistically, we paid a price in order to get part-time people. But up until this year, we haven't had the money to actually use them. Beginning in January, it is our wish that we are going to use them. The net result is going to be four part-time officers. Hopefully, they may be reinstatements. They may be retirees from our own department with a lot of experience, certainly at the airport and everywhere. This $5,200 request is for uniforms and equipment. Might not necessarily be for those people, but it would be for whoever backfills their position, and currently it's not in the contract. And that's going to be a cost that we will have every year. These next two are our attempt at realistic budgeting. These are fairly high-priced pieces of equipment that we routinely have to replace. And normally when we replace them, they're all kind of like in a heap in the middle of the floor, and we have to replace, come to you and get a contingent draw for a large sum of money to replace a whole bunch of radios or patrol rifles. We've worked on a schedule where they're replaced so many at a time. Hopefully that cuts down on having to send them out for repairs. I know just a portable radio, the average repair bill for a portable radio is along the lines of like $600, where a radio itself costs about $2,400. Certainly they can't be out on the street without a radio. So we've worked in a replacement schedule, and we know that they're recurring costs and feel as though they should be part of target. Number six, the Offender Watch service contract. If you recall last year, Offender Watch is our sex offender registry. And we came to you with, actually with the support of IT. It was an in-house system that we used for the sex offender registry. That no longer exists, and Offender Watch is a group that's outsourced pretty much around the country. We did not know that this wasn't part of the resolution. It's obviously every year that maintenance cost is in there, and really that was an oversight on the original resolution. And we feel it has to be in target. Number seven, we are also polling. Reason being, the CGR report strongly suggests the possibility that something may be done with the administrative side of the sheriff's office, which may result in some construction, and this area may not even exist at that point. I got to be honest, in formulating this year's budget, I think everyone will agree, it was very difficult because we have two major studies going on right now. You're trying to hit a moving target that's almost impossible to hit at this point. As you'll notice, we did not ask for any staffing increases, although I believe they're probably warranted. But that's going to be for us to collectively decide what the staffing levels should be, basically what the face of policing is going to look like in Tompkins County. So we did leave it alone. With the use of part-timers at the airport, which we have been able to do, we actually do have a net one increase of a full-time deputy out on the street, which is obviously a good thing. I would like to see where both of the deputy positions that were originally slated to be at the airport were out on the road doing police work, and we can backfill that with part-time folks, whether it be retired or whomever. It just stands to reason that you want your full-time deputies out doing actual police work and not sitting guard basically at the airport.
Questions for the sheriff, the undersheriff? Martha.
When you say, Brian, when you say we're pulling it, I mean, you're not requesting anymore.
We're not requesting it anymore, no.
That was for the bulletproof glass, and then I maybe didn't quite catch what you said about the number one priority, the clerk.
Yeah. We had originally asked for an account permit clerk. Back in the day, prior to 2009, there were five support staff in that office. Today, there are three. This being the fourth one, we do actually have a position for the fourth one. Again, without getting into a personnel matter, we needed to find a way to fill that position. Mm-hmm. And through the help of administration and personnel, we are now doing that, hopefully on a full-time basis eventually.
So you're saying you've already figured out how to get it into your budget this year?
Well, we can get that person into our budget because we are not paying the person that vacated the position. So,
okay. You had four that were funded?
We have the funds available to do that.
Okay.
Brian, my question is about the radios. Do you all have a regular replacement schedule on those things that you don't?
No.
You don't?
No. We usually come to you and say, hey, we need, X number of radios.
Does it make any sense to have one of those?
To have what?
Joe?
That's what they're trying to do through this line item.
So I'm
putting a target next to it. This would allow them to have a routine replacement. Same thing with the rifles that are on there.
Okay. Mike and then Anna.
Pistol permits have me interested. You said they've gone up a lot. Any idea how many pistol permits are in Tompkins County?
I don't know exactly, Mike, at this time, but we do know that the applications has really increased a lot. I mean, I know the state doesn't even know because when they started the SAFE Act this year and they're asking people to register their weapons and through the state also, they only sent out 339,000 letters. That's all they were able to get addresses for, I guess, or whatever their excuse was. And I know there's more than that in the state of New York. Okay, there's no doubt in my mind. So, but I'm sure we could probably get a number.
I wondered, since the SAFE Act, have we seen the applications for pistols go up?
Yes.
A lot?
Yeah, a lot.
Do you think you attribute that to that?
A lot of it, yes. Yes, sir.
Yep. Anna.
Thank you.
And this is just for me being still relatively new. The funding of the contribution to the emergency response team, You described it a little bit, but can you describe a bit more of what we have, what our country, how many people we have? It's SWAT plus something. If you could just go there.
Yes. We'll take the more classic part of this, and it would be the county city combined SWAT team. There are it's a bit in flux, but call it 20 total members of the SWAT team. And we have at any given time between 4 and 5 members on that from our department. We have never budgeted for our SWAT members, and basically the city does for the entire SWAT team. And they end up spending roughly $12,000 of their budget
for
our members. Yes.
And is that all? I mean, when you're on the SWAT team, that's it. It's a separate team. That's 20. That's
yeah, you want to use the microphone, please?
Yeah, absolutely. SWAT team, that's their full-time job?
No.
Okay. So just so I understand, how many calls, how many times do they get pulled into active?
They train twice a week or twice a month.
Okay.
This $12,000 target request is simply things like ammunition to train with, uniforms, that sort of stuff. We pay our people. The city does not pay our people, but it's simply money to it's basically money to train and to outfit.
So the work that they do then is they're on the general rounds of road patrol, and then if the SWAT team is needed, then they are all activated for that.
They are all activated via cell phone immediately, whether they're home, whether they're working. It doesn't matter.
Last question. How many calls to activate the SWAT team are there per, like, month?
Oh, I wouldn't say they're monthly. No.
Per year, then?
Well, it depends. I mean, some of them, the classic SWAT operation, very rarely. Now, they will use them for, like, high-risk search warrants. If they've developed information that there's possibly a gun in the residence or something like that, they will use members of the SWAT team to conduct entry into that. That happens a good bit, I would say. Yeah, probably a couple times a month. But it's just for the entry, and it's a safety thing. That's why they do it. And they're highly trained to do it. But they just make the entry and then they leave. You know, then it's up to the investigators and so forth. You really can't put a number on it. It's when they're called, they go.
Just getting a sense of the rhythm.
Martha.
So pistol permits have gone up, you say, a lot. Has anybody had their guns confiscated since the SAFE Act? Never mind, don't answer that.
We will not get into the confiscation of guns for the SAFE Act. That'll be a state police problem. We do confiscate guns, though, when people violate the court orders and things like that the judges ask us to do, Martha. We do that. But we will not get involved with the SAFE Act, the state police reason. And right now they're not even sure about what they're going to do for compensation. Last time I spoke to them, they're not even sure.
Thank you.
I will.
Also on pistol, Ken, just magnitude of numbers and the number of permits currently, what compared to what used to be, any sense of how many we're talking?
Yeah, we don't have that number available, but I will have it for the next public safety meeting and give you the number.
Are we talking dozens, hundreds, thousands?
I would guess 1,000. I bet you it's increased over the year. I'll bet you. I mean, that's just my guess.
And are we seeing a comparable increase in other firearms, or is it or do we not?
No, I mean, what we deal with ours are pistol permits,
yeah.
So it has no dealings with long guns or assault weapons and things like that. Nothing at all as far as that, unless we confiscate them on an order.
Okay, thank you.
Dooley, last question.
Will one of you please make a brief but strong case for a second nurse?
For what?
A second nurse.
Dooley, please use the microphone, would you?
That's
what I thought I was talking about.
We haven't gotten there yet. That's the next presentation.
Jail.
That's the jail. We're getting ready to do that.
I thought that was where the nurse was.
No, that's coming right up. Actually, I do want to, because everybody else mentioned it, as if we need some more moving targets, raise the age. We have no idea what that's going to do for us, other than we are almost assured that we are going to have many juvenile transports. And as of today, there is a facility near
Hudson, New York,
Buffalo, and one in the lower Hudson. And it is not out of the realm of possibility, just so you can kind of plan for it. A juvenile would get committed by a judge to one of those facilities, and so you have to make that transport, and the next day they have to come back to court because we can't house them. So you're going back down to pick them up, bring them to court, and the judge may very well say, okay, you've made your appearance, now go on back. So that's three trips to somewhere for one person. So that's what we have to look forward to.
I want to move on to the jail, if we could do that.
Yep.
Anna, but go ahead, quickly.
We went to the conference that we just went to. There's seven facilities that they are going to build to adjust. Are any of them any closer? Have you heard anything about the seven they're building?
As far as building new ones?
Mm-hmm.
No. All I've heard is when I met with them, and I'm familiar with Hudson because that's where I was born and raised in Columbia County, they already have a facility there that they are taking all the rest of the inmates out of and building it, or not building it, making it so it's available for exactly what we're talking about. The one in Buffalo I'm not familiar with. I mean, nonetheless, we're in the middle. They're both about three-hour trips one way. So
we're hoping they use the facility in Lansing.
There is talk of that.
That would be really great.
There is talk. They told us that they filed for 35 beds to be able to use for that, and we're hoping that comes through because that would be really good for us.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that.
I really don't think it's going to matter because the state's probably going to pay the whole bill for all of this stuff.
I have a bridge in Florida to sell you, Brian.
Could we maybe carry this on another time? Jail, please.
Okay.
Sorry.
Here's our jail numbers that we're looking at for this year. And we'll go in as we did as the road and our major influences. Obviously, we had a wage increase due to the 2017 settlement agreement. Along with that, though, we also got with them a use of part-time corrections officers. And we truly believe that the way that's going to be set up once we start to get, obviously, the bodies to fill those should help us immensely. They were very cordial in these negotiations, the corrections staff, and filling in the slots that they felt was necessary. We couldn't but help to agree with them. And so we look forward to this, and I believe it will be a big part of savings and better quality of life for our corrections officers to get time off. Phone commission revenue, that is a big thing, always has been. There's been a lot of movement trying to take that away. It's been fought for very strongly by the Sheriff's Association to maintain that because it is a big revenue. And so far, we have no indication that we're going to lose it this year. So, again, you'll see the numbers. They increase by two, but again, that's because of the part-time people that we're going to be putting in there. So it's not hiring anybody new to at full-time rates or any fringes.
And that two actually represents four part-time or half-time people. Again, we're targeting potential reinstatements or retirees for those. The OTR is not supported by the administration budget. This is similar to the one for the road. We do have a clothing budget for outfitting corrections officers. However, we are now going to have an additional four people. So that's what that figure represents. It's simply uniforms and equipment. And lastly, this was a strong recommendation coming out of the CGR report. I have always anticipated conversation about this. I will just say that if you do the math, which I've done, there's 168 hours in a week, and the jail is open every one of those. We have a nurse that works 40. If she does not take a day off, we have people coming in there at all times of the day. Many of them are in need of mental health services, regular health services, addictions, and they need to be seen. If we're really going to help these folks, they've got to be seen. Obviously, we don't have the resources to have someone on staff 24 hours a day, nor do we necessarily need that. But we certainly need somebody there every day. As it is now, the nurse that we do have, she's great. She even staggers her days off. She does not schedule herself for consecutive days off. Doesn't feel as though that would be healthy for the inmates to potentially be 3 days without being seen. Obviously, if there's an acute situation going on, the corrections officers will take appropriate action. They'll call for an ambulance. They may have a call down for assistance from mental health to see if they can get someone up there. I think the consensus is, and for those folks that were on the jail study committee, I'm sure they heard a lot about this topic and actually suggested that we strongly recommend this position.
I just want to make a comment, Brian. In the county administrator's sheet that he gave us, it obviously is part of the CGR recommendation, and I think during the voting meetings that come in October, it will be addressed strongly. Go ahead, Will, and then Ann.
Thanks, Jim. You talked about the phone services contract. I was looking in your budget. Is that other revenue sources? Where does that show up, and what's the magnitude?
For the phone services.
Oh, the phone. It's in revenue. Yeah. So it'd be phone commissions.
Is that part of the $120,000 of other? And
That's the increase.
Please use your microphone.
That's the increase. I'm sorry. So when you see the revenues in the recommended budget, it's slide. two or one. It says it's going up 6,000, so we actually haven't been budgeting where it should be for revenue, what we've been taking in for phone commissions. So we're doing it more realistically about where we should be about bringing in for phone revenue.
So I'm trying to understand the magnitude, how much revenue we're getting from that service.
off the top of my head, I don't know the number, but it's
240. I'm sorry?
Is it on page 240 somewhere?
You could get back to us with that, you know.
What is it?
I mean, I can send you the accurate numbers because I can give you an actual breakdown of what we get.
Okay, I guess where I'm going, and maybe this is not the time or place, but as you know, there have been criticisms of the high fees that are charged to inmates for use of phones. And I realize that it's a complicated thing. It's not simply, it's just a matter. But I'm a little uneasy with thinking of it just primarily in revenue terms, because there's a human dimension as well. Mm-hmm. And
we actually, we get it through Global Tech Services. It's actually through a third party. So, I mean, we receive revenue from them, so... It's a vendor that comes out.
So do you have just in general, again, maybe this could be a committee, but what does it cost to make local phone calls for inmates? Do we know?
Honestly, I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
We generally get a large check off, you know, from monthly from GTL. So, I mean, I could give you a breakdown of that at a later time.
Okay, thank you.
Anna.
Actually, my question is pretty rudimentary, I think. I'm just trying to figure out the numbers. In the full-time equivalents, you have an increase from 2017 to 2018, which is just four half-time employees. Is that what's being requested or being put into the base budget that you've already worked out, and that's already
in.
Okay,
yeah,
so right. It doesn't include the nurse.
No,
that's the over-target request.
Right.
Okay, thanks.
Martha and then Mike Lane.
On the nurse, if this is granted, we're talking about renovating space. Can you integrate a new nurse without renovation to the space? Because we surely won't have that done by next year.
We can, because they won't be working at the same time.
Right. And another added to that, this has come up, especially with the smaller corrections facilities, and some of them, you know, have a part-time nurse, and the State Commission has really started to suggest to them, you might want to get at least a full-time one for the small jail. So it's coming, because we feel, as you saw from the study too, that it could help with decreasing the population. If there's somebody there to take a quick look at somebody that's just come in, as Brian said, you know, you've got addiction, you've got medicines that are taken for other illnesses, and mental health. And if you've got somebody on the floor that can address it immediately, we can get that prisoner, or inmate, excuse me, out the door into a facility where they need to go and not ours. So.
Okay, so I assume they would overlap a little bit, right? It would seem.
From my conversations with the present nurse, days might overlap, but she's talking about overlapping a couple of days, maybe a couple of hours, just to compare notes on people. But these would be she could work, you know, late afternoon, evening, type thing.
Okay.
There's no reason to have two there during the day. No.
Right. The idea is, of course, to extend coverage.
Right.
So, okay. But I would be happy to see a little, you know, enough overlap so they could coordinate.
Yeah.
I'm looking for, I think this is in the CGR report, and we just, you know, we're talking about it today at public safety, and I can't find it now. But I saw somewhere that the city Ithaca Police Department, am I correct, that they operate 4 days on and 2 days off, but they have a shift is 8.25 hours. We have 8 hours, but we do 5 days on, 2 days off. Am I right, or is
how much time we got? But
okay,
yeah,
I mean,
there are vast differences in collective bargaining agreements. Let's put it that way.
And also scheduling.
Yeah. Scheduling, yes. But you are correct. That, I happen to know both these contracts pretty well, and that the IPD contract is 243 8-hour days a year, whereas ours is 200 and it's not 260, it's about 257. Yeah. So okay. That's a good starting point.
Got it. Okay, I was just trying to figure, is there a way to do, and now we're back to road probably instead of corrections, but so if there was a way of looking at longer days but fewer, does that provide efficiencies? And that's another conversation.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Mike Lane.
Glad to hear about the negotiations for the part-timers. Been asking for 25 years about why we don't have part-timers, and I'm always told it's because it's in our contract. I wonder, can you talk to sheriffs around the region? Do they all have that provision in their contract that restricts part-timers?
No, they do not. Schuyler County has had part-timers. I worked for them when I retired from Cuyahoga Heights part-time. So, no, they've had it. Other counties do, too. I'm not sure all of them, obviously, Mike.
I find it a very offensive provision of our contract, labor contract. I think it's feather-bedding to increase the availability of overtime, which to me ought to be a management decision whether we use part-timers or not.
Well, that's why we negotiated hard for it, and we're glad we got it. So.
Gee, you should be at the table next time, Mike. You know. any other questions? Dooley.
Never know.
I'm following up on the phone commission question. You said that you contract with a particular company, but I was looking at the contracts page in Appendix B, page 12, and I didn't recognize the name you mentioned. Would you say it again, please?
It's GTL or Global Tech. But...
Well, what's what I see? I don't see
it's just
that.
It's the company that we receive the revenue in from, so right. It's not something that would be in as a contract per se. So.
Yeah, GTL is the supplier.
The supplier.
Okay, and for most all corrections facilities in the state.
There's nothing that says that we have to use that, is there?
We've got to use somebody, and that's what is who we've used, and that's who, like I say, most everybody in the state uses that supplier.
Rich, I hope that you can take this up more at your committee.
Certainly.
Thank you. Thank you, all three of you.
Thank you.
For two shots. Emergency response. Lee, I want your most concise, short explanation you can give.
Thank you, Brian.
Jim, you have very high expectations if you expect me to be concise after all these years, but I'll do my best.
Okay, thank you.
Good evening, everybody. And I know this has been a long night for you, so I will try to move it right along. And I think this is probably, in all the years of doing the budgets, this is probably the most positive one that I've been able to bring forward, and one that I think gives us some long-sought relief and a little bit of breathing room, and reflects a long-awaited state contribution that I've been promising you for years would materialize. How long we keep it's the next question. The budget, target budget, is at a 0% increase, and part of all of what drives that comes in the form of a grant that I'll talk about in just a few moments. I would like to just talk a little bit about some of the major influences that go into developing the budget for the Department of Emergency Response. And I do this because I want you to understand the steadily increasing workload that the department has experienced since we went through consolidation about 15 years ago. And as we have employed and installed and began to use numerous systems been able to build the capital projects out as were long planned. In 2008, when we started a new radio system, be 10 years next year, we had about a little over 1,000 system users. Today, it's up to 1,700. This reflects a participation by additional agencies that weren't part of that first public safety procurement. We're working today with a number of local governments, the transportation systems, even the school systems are starting to be a part of the radio communications that you've underwritten at a county level. Number of radio transmissions, our first full year of system usage, a little over 2 million times that radio system was used. Last year it was used over 3 million times. So we'll break the 50% mark and increase the use of that system in 7 years. That'll happen this year. We'll be well over that 3.078. The same time, number of dispatched incidents, those calls taken by 911 and given out to the public safety response agencies have shown a 30% increase in 10 years. Now, the amazing thing with all of this is that we've been able to keep the staffing levels flat through that period of time. And our way of accommodating that, even with the increased supervision, implementation of new standards, training requirements, so on, a lot of that has to do with the fact that you invested over $20 million into modern technology for the communications systems. And we continue to leverage those investments every day. Projects. You're going to hear a lot of alliteration with the word P tonight. Department continues to administer, to implement a variety of projects. And in the last 4 years, we've completely replaced the 911 phone system, expanded our mobile data communications into fire and emergency medical services in addition to law enforcement. We've done a complete communications operations platform. Our radio consoles were refreshed and moved to digital technology that wasn't available when we built the system out 10 years ago. Greg probably talked to you a little while earlier about the database conversion project, which is one of many initiatives that he has to improve the server-based systems that are operating in the county. We're continuing to implement a text-to-voice that would automate our paging processes. This has been a 2-year project funded by Homeland Security grants. We continue to expand upon our regional operability, interoperability, merging our communications with others in the region and adjacent counties. We just completed a $2.8 million grant in March that enabled us to link to the other counties and begin to implement technological solutions to make these communication systems talk to each other. On the horizon are next generation 911 initiatives and public safety broadband. These are massive changes that will occur over the next 5 to 10 years in how we transmit information among our public safety community. And I know at the public safety meeting this afternoon, as the consultant was talking to the committee about the impact of body cameras, that same type of impact is going to occur as we begin to change or receive different mediums of communication in the 911 center. We're beginning to receive text messages. We'll be receiving pictures, streaming video, all those things that you do on your cell phones, smartphones today. Those are going to be communication means coming into the 911 center. That has real far-ranging implications for how we share this information, how we record it, how we archive it, and how we implement it into the day-to-day operations. A lot of minds are going to have to be put to the test to figure out how to make this changing technology work for us. Public safety broadband, our mobile data system is something that we control locally today. Within the next 5 to 10 years, we will probably become part of something called FirstNet, a national public safety broadband system. And again, how we integrate is going to be subject to a lot of discussion moving forward.
how have we been able to make this happen within the budget? Through a number of grants that have been made available to us. Many of these are formula-based reimbursement grants or dollars that are placed out there at this federal and state level that we're able to apply for and put towards our communications and operational needs. We have an emergency management planning grant that helps to pay some of the funds for our assistant directors. We have a public safety answering point grant that now has become a reimbursement-based grant that allows us to recoup some of our costs in operating the 911 center. We're now seeing an annual $5,000 a year hazardous materials planning grant that allows our hazmat team to be able to attend and travel and train to get their specialty and also acquire equipment. State Homeland Security grant, again, this is one that comes down from the federal level that has allowed us to buy things such as the text-to-voice system and, of course, the interoperable communications grant that I spoke of earlier. This is probably the key one. Up until the last couple years, if you had projects to regionalize your communication system, you could apply for a piece of a $50 or $60 million grant fund. We did that a few years ago, and that's what paid for our linking with other counties and upgrading our communications capabilities. As of this year, this has been turned into a formula-based reimbursement grant to the tune of $700,000 that we can apply to the state to have sustainment costs on our communication system reimbursed to us. This is the first year that it will happen. It is our hope that this continues to happen. I've maintained since we attempted to partner with the statewide wireless network, SWN, and since we moved forward on the project, that eventually it would have to come to this, and it has come to this. The problem with this grant is that it looks good this year, and it may look good next year during the election year, but we have no guarantee that it is going to continue to be reappropriated on an annual basis. We have hopes that it will. It comes out of the statewide wireless surcharge, but it's very tricky to figure out if you're going to have this for the long term. Some major influences or stresses as we move along. I've talked to you about the diminishing landline revenue. At this point, we get a dollar per month surcharge on landline telephones. That number continues to go down, and for the last 3 years, we've been off by about $60,000 or $70,000 based on those diminishing landlines. We have a little bit of relief coming in that we've been able to extend the surcharge to the prepaid wireless devices. Joe and I have kind of kicked that around. It could be anywhere from $40,000 to $60,000. But we're still going to continue to see a declining revenue stream tied to the surcharges, so we need to be careful. Uncertainty of continued funding, the PSAP grants, the Homeland Security grants, the interoperable communications grants, they're there right now. But if the state or federal governments get into some budget crunches, they could be gone overnight. Technology and equipment, refreshment and replacement. The sheriff talked to you the previous session here about the need to replace radios. We're no different either. We have millions and millions of dollars worth of equipment that was purchased through the capital program to build out our radio communications and telephone systems. That all eventually has to be replaced. And as I've told you each year that I've been here, we have no equipment lines in our budget to support that regular replacement. That's where this grant comes into it. Programs, projects, permanent support, succession planning. Here's another P word. This is all around people. And this is another influence in how this budget has been developed. As far as these communications programs, projects, and program support goes, you've got a half a dozen people in our office that administer that side of the house that are not dispatchers or dispatch operations-related employees. Five of those six people are either eligible now for retirement or will be within the next 1 to 2 years. That includes me. And I, not that I'm saying anything's going to happen, but it's an eventuality that I think you need to begin to prepare for. And I've been concerned for the last few years about how a succession, how a transition may take place. I don't want to make this about me, but give it a little bit of thought as we move forward. I've been your director for 16 years, and we've had some great successes, and it's been a very good time. But I'm a unique individual. I'm a single person with no kids, at least none that I've been informed about. I don't take vacations. I bought on to 24/7 coverage, and aside from a day or two trip to Albany or Washington a few times a year, I'm here locally and responding. I think it would be naive and probably unrealistic to think that in the future you'd be able to hire a director that could give you that and expect to still have a family life at home. And I think we got to think about that a little bit. The other thing is that when these five or six people hit the point that they choose to retire or move on in their careers, you've got decades worth of institutional memory and know-how that will be leaving us. And part of my desire in putting this budget together is to try to build a little bit of capacity and try to expand that knowledge base so that if I hit the lottery and go tomorrow or this whole crew hits it together on a joint ticket, you've still got something in place that is going to maintain the continuity of the operations. Now, Joe and I have talked about some different ways to approach this, and as part of this, the grant that we're receiving, I put a placeholder in there with a suggestion that we look to refund what used to be the fire, disaster, and EMS coordinator's position. It remains on the books. It's rated. It's there. But it was consolidated into my director's job when Jack Miller retired in 2002. Joe suggested another way that we may want to look at this is maybe it's time, as the complexity of the operation increases, that we look toward hiring a deputy director, that we could begin to spread out some of these responsibilities. A third option may be that we take the interim assistant director's position that we've been funding through grants and look at making that position or something similar available to at least take on some of the program and project management activities. So a lot of thinking needs to go into this. But the fact that we have $700,000 made available through reimbursements gives us a little bit of flexibility. The second part of this is that we've desired, right since we started the system, to be able to create some type of a reserve fund so that we can look toward replacement of the radio communication systems in a reasonable time period. Over the past few months, we've begun to see generators that are starting to fail and age out. We're seeing heating and ventilation units out at the radio communication sites. They're 10 years old, operate 24 hours a day. We have reserve battery banks that fund uninterruptible power supplies. Those are just a handful of components that we need to be replacing on a regular basis. Every year, Dooley has asked me in the past about an equipment replacement program. This is that equipment replacement program, or the beginning of that, so that as we pay off the leases on the communication system, as we move toward those bonds timing out, we can at least start to put away and have funds available to do some of the replacement and plan it on a more regular basis. So my suggestion to you through this budget is to allow us to add a little bit of capacity to the administrative side of the house and to begin a replacement reserve fund similar to for what we do with the airport highway facilities so that we can look toward the regular and routine and scheduled replacement of the radio system components. Full-time equivalencies with the position that I've requested put us at 30.50. Since 2004, we've bounced between 28 and 32 full-time equivalencies. We've either contracted or expanded based on the given needs, retirements, consolidations of positions. But essentially, you're at the same number of people funding one permanently now that we've been at for some time. One last piece here. I've probably got you spinning here with this information. But there is one over-target request that we've put in jointly between the Council of Governments, my office, and the County Administrator's office, a one-time funding request for $25,000 that would be put toward consulting support of the Emergency Medical Services Task Force. I know some of the committees have been briefed on the work of the EMS Task Force. Irene Weisner is here tonight, who chairs the task force and also chairs the Council of Governments. And we've made a lot of good, steady progress in our first few months as a task force. And we've certainly identified a number of very difficult problems that need to be addressed. The one thing we haven't gotten to are solutions. What we're finding is that EMS is an extremely complicated, complex subject, and for us to effectuate some long-term changes means that we need to have a much better understanding of the regulatory and educational components that are out there. It looks to us as though legal counsel that understands the ins and outs of state and federal law and health department requirements would be well advised as we begin to craft these solutions. And it's possible as well that we would be looking for some help in facilitating conversations with the various stakeholders. You've got over 20 entities that provide some level of EMS. You've got 20-some municipalities and local taxing jurisdictions that have a share in EMS provision. And to get all of these entities together to come up with a shared vision and outline our expectations and needs moving forward is going to take a lot of conversation, and it probably requires a little bit more support than what we have today. And at this point, I guess I'd ask Joe if you want to weigh in on it, because it was your suggestion that we incorporate it into this budget to move forward.
Yeah, I spoke at public safety just before this meeting. We think this is a really important expenditure. Dan also serves on the task force. Irene has done a tremendous job leading it to this point, but it does now need some expert consulting and facilitation assistance. And, again, it's the color coding. This is one that I would not only suggest that you fund, but strongly suggest you fund, to the point that if it's clear in October, when you pass your tentative budget, that you support this, we may even ask to get advance funding on it. If it's clear that we're going to take the money out of the bank anyway, we may ask for advance funding on this to make sure that we don't lose the momentum that's been created in this project.
Questions for Lee? Martha.
Did you breathe in all that time? thank you, Lee. I'm a little confused about the fire disaster coordinator and the so it's an additional FTE. Previous slide to that. So is that in the budget already? I don't see it as an OTR.
That's in the recommended budget. It wasn't an over target because I used target monies to fund it from the interoperable communications grant. I took a portion of that anticipated amount to fund it.
So that was the $700,000 grant?
Correct.
So how much is that position?
It would be, for the sake of the budgeting here, about $100,000, including benefits, 65 plus 50% fringe benefit rate.
So does that
It's about in line with what a deputy commissioner or deputy director in most departments would be making.
Okay, but it is a grant. You said you weren't sure, what, you know, will it continue after the election?
If we lost it in future years, we'd have to come back and evaluate the position.
Will this cut in at all to what else is supposed to be funded with that grant?
No, because what we're doing is we're taking the existing maintenance and service contracts and billing those to the state as eligible expenses, so it creates a revenue that was unanticipated.
Okay.
And see, with the surcharge revenues, I have to be very careful, and with this grant, that the 3411 budget, the account 3411, which is the system support, approximates what we receive from surcharge and surcharge reimbursement. And we can't apply much of that to the operating budget for the department, but you can fund everything like your radio system support, telephone system support, electricity, all those types of things that keeps our sites active.
Okay, so this is a new position. You haven't asked specifically for it on, I mean, how does this work with you, Joe?
It's within target. Remember, target is based on your local dollar expenditures.
Okay.
So we look at target. This is well within his target, this position.
Okay.
So it didn't need an over target. This is within.
And you would support that, or you do support this?
The position? I do.
Okay. Thank
anyone
you.
Anyone else? Thank you, Lee. Nice job.
Thank you.
All right. Just so you know, everyone, we're back here tomorrow night. We're back here Thursday night. We have a budget forum on October 2nd, and October 10, 12, and 16 are voting meetings. October 17 is a vote on the tentative budget, and October 31st is Halloween. We're done here. Thank you.